Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Hot D, the officially unofficial podcast for House of the Dragon on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 5, "The We Light the Way." That's the title of this episode. You said those are house words of who?
House Hightower. If you'll recall, Okay. Their keep is essentially a massive lighthouse that guides the way to the harbor town of Old Town. And that high tower has a beacon, and apparently some new lore we got that when in times of war, when they're calling their banners, they light that thing up green.
How do they do that? Wildfire gels over the
I imagine some type of copper compound, right? That's how you turn a it's like that those flames. In the Christmas time they sell those little packets of crystals you can throw in there. I think that's like copper sulfate or something.
Yeah, or Doc Brown makes a package for that. You could get some blue flames, you can get some red
flames. Maybe it's wildfire. There's like, fuck it.
That's light, what I'm thinking, yeah.
Yeah, we'll get some wildfire going up there.
Mm-hmm. I hope they built that tower strong, because, boy, that wildfire is hot. I've seen it in action.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I suppose that's a fitting name for this episode, even though they don't feel super powerful at the moment. You got a queen that's a high tower, but all the action seems to be happening like around her. I think that's starting to change though. This episode, this is the one where she decides, I'm not going to be a passive observer here. I got to get in the game.
Yeah. Sounds like she's going to actually put her hand on the wheel and start driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll say, I think this episode is better on second watch, richer. It's not as surprising, obviously. I wasn't as shocked by the ending, but it was definitely richer. You see all the pieces moving around, and that's what I come to this show for. So I was happy to see that. What'd you think of it?
Once I watched it the second and third time, when I was relaxed and wasn't worried about, like, God, this isn't happening at all like I thought it was happening. And, like, why is this moment here? And why is that moment? It's also remarkably a litmus test for the unreliability of eyewitness accounts, because I made a couple statements on the instant take about, like, where I thought Laenor was in relation to Joffrey Lonmouth, and, you know, who punched who, and I got that shit way wrong. Because I think it did.
The answer is always Kristen.
It's always Kristen. He's doing the most this episode. And, like, I thought that was kind of interesting that when I was watching this and they filmed it so chaotically, and I did feel like an observer, just like, what the hell's going on? What the hell's going on? That I got so many details wrong in the first blush. And when I was actually sitting and watching a replay and taking notes, I'm like, oh, God, why did I think that Laenor saw him from across the hall when he's literally like 6 feet away from him at his feet? Why did I think the Kingsguard, like, thought that was interesting.
Chaotic. Yeah, totally. I mean, that scene is amazingly filmed.
It's a masterclass of filming.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the suspense, the mystery of what's going on. You're kind of right there with Viserys. I really love that final scene. It's super good. Not to, you know, say the other scenes aren't, but man, I was impressed by that one.
Yeah, I was really excited, or I was really happy with the way it ends up. And again, they are doing that thing, which I think is so interesting, something I did not expect, that they're kind of showing that this historical account in Fire and Blood, all of it has elements of truth. You know, there's not one, like, I thought the mushroom account would be the ridiculous one that nobody everyone's got a little element of the truth in Fire and Blood, and seeing how these things are playing out, and, like, minor differences, and, like, not just differences in, like, historical fact, but, like, looking back opinion, something that Kim Renfro has been talking about the last few weeks is, if you read Fire and Blood, you come away with the idea that Viserys's reign was pretty well regarded 200 years later. You know, like, oh, he's shepherded the apex of the Targaryen rule and blah, 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 all this stuff. Whereas we're seeing more of a weak, ineffectual placeholder king that's just trying at best to keep what his dad had built going.
Yeah, totally.
And yeah, I'm really digging it. I'm really digging it.
I really love the way that they recontextualized for us Lady Rhea, I think is her name. It's Daemon's wife, because I had a certain opinion of her based on the things that Daemon had said about her. I think that opinion was entirely false, and I think that's it's so biased from Daemon's side, and I should have seen it, right? Because he's the only one who's talked about her.
Yeah, he's not a reliable job. Speaking of unreliable witnesses, although it is super funny how in 5 episodes he's been banished from King's Landing 3 times. Mm-hmm. No, twice. And he's returned 3 times, and like this one where Viserys is looking at him and like, yeah, fine, get him a chair. He just keeps getting away with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's he going to do? He's not going to kill him, right? So, yeah.
What is Daemon going to do? That's a question that is on a lot of people's minds in the realm, I'm sure.
Well, what is Viserys going to do about Daemon? I'm like, the guy just keeps showing up. What are you going to lock him in a dungeon? You're going to banish him and keep like a guard on him? I don't know. Take away his dragon, I guess.
And also remember that, like, just killing him is probably off the table because, if you'll recall, that is such a huge taboo, kinslaying in Westeros, that I don't even think it occurs to Viserys that, like, you know, that would be, although politically that might be the most expedient thing you can do.
Oh, yeah. I think if he had like a little finger or someone in his service that he could maybe, you know. I never told him to kill him. You know, I said I got a problem. It'd be great if it went away, but I never said to kill him. I don't know. He seems like a real problem.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Maybe we should get into the recap because we got a lot to talk about.
There is action-packed episode. Yeah, this is great. Like, a lot of people are considering this the best episode thus far. Yeah.
I agree.
I've heard from some of my friends who have fucking screener copies that the next episode is also a banger. And I think that's the end of that's the end of the initial screeners that they sent out to critics. I'm sure there'll be more forthcoming. But a lot of people have called it the best of the bunch. So nice. I'm really excited for next week, too.
Mm-hmm. All right. We start off with Daemon's wife, Lady Rhea Royce, outriding when Daemon returns to the Vale. And she insults him before realizing he's there to kill her, which he then does. Spooks her horse and it topples over on top of her. I guess breaking her spine, severing, you know, her spinal cord, whatever. She insults him and he puts a rock to her head.
Daemon's, before we get into anything else, I want to make a shallow observation. Daemon's hood looks ridiculous. I don't know if it's the wind blowing into it, but it looks like he's wearing a 10-gallon cowboy hat underneath his hood.
Yeah,
and it gives like him a very bobblehead helmet. It gives him a very bobblehead looking appearance.
Yeah. No, I hate it. It's a bad cloak.
You don't even have to Funko Pop this guy. It's just you just mm-hmm. print, you 3D print him as is and it'll look like a Funko Pop.
Enlarge his eyes, whatever. 20%, you're good.
Maybe.
Here's the thing I noticed about the scene. Daemon doesn't say a word. Again,
he does that a lot.
Like the one
at
the Stepstones where, you know, mm-hmm. he gets off his dragon, he gets the message, he beats the messenger, and then he goes and does his crab feeder thing. This was similar.
Do you think he came here to kill her? Because I don't know what else he would be here to do.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. He's not here because Viserys sent him home, right? There's no way he was just like, yeah, Viserys is right. I'm going to go home. So, yeah, I feel like that was the inevitable outcome here. But, I mean, I guess to what end? Is he seriously thinking that if he kills his wife here, he'll now be free of the burden of marriage and Viserys will marry Rhaenyra to him?
That's the calculus. I think that's the calculus once late, like whatever he intended when he showed up to Lady Rhys quarters and met her in the wilderness of the veil of Aaron. I think that once he did commit to killing her, that's exactly where his mental math went, led him. Yeah, like, ooh,
that's
this is
crazy talk, though, right? Like, the stopper here wasn't, oh, you're married. The stopper here was, I hate you. You're Daemon Targaryen. You're insane. I'm not going to marry my daughter to you.
Yeah, but is Viserys strong enough to gainsay Rhaenyra? Is he strong enough to gainsay Daemon? Like, if they both had their heart set on it. I also think that Daemon is probably unaware of Rhaenyra's being forced into marriage. So, like, you know, the fact that, like, you know, the Valyrians is a much better match, I think, than Daemon. Yeah, I think he thinks he's got a shot. It does seem like that. And that's one of the other things about, like, man, the way that thing shot went in the end, it's like the way they used a crowd to kind of like as a veil. So you don't really get to see these crucial moments of, and then once you're like, oh my God, did he kiss Rhaenyra? Did he choke Rhaenyra? Did he? And then someone starts screaming and now your attention's directed to the guy getting beat to death. So
yeah,
I thought like I, because the thing is, as, there, I was listening to a couple different podcasts and I was reading some stuff and people were debating about whether, you know, he meant to kill her when she was paralyzed, whether he meant to finish her off. And I'm like, I didn't think there was any instance where Lady Rhea walks out of that valley. Like, I think she's dead. And I don't like people like, oh, he was going to let her go. And then she taunted him. I'm like, ah, I don't. I mean, they definitely filmed it with a hint of that. But like, the idea that he would leave her paralyzed there, potentially to be discovered still alive for her to like finger him is kind of nuts.
Yeah, she can still speak. She's still coherent here. Yeah. So, yeah, Gerald walks by, rides by, whatever, and sees her. And she's like, Daemon did this to me. You're going to have some trouble.
So I think it also has become more sharply in focus why Daemon hates Lady Rhea here, because
she hates him.
Well, but I got the distinct opinion that they tried to consummate and he couldn't. And it has nothing to do with her attractiveness, has nothing to do with her personality. Mm-hmm. It's just starting to be a thing that Daemon does, and that his kind of shame and distress at that caused him to just completely abandon and write off this relationship and talk shit behind her to anybody preemptively to head off any attacks against his manhood.
Yeah, that could definitely be the root of it. I feel like there's more to it, though, right? She hates him for who he is, not just not being able
to. But do you think, because they've been married for, I think, at this point, 9 or 10 years. But I'm like, when they were getting betrothed, did she hate him back then? Or did she come to loathe him because of his reaction and all that? We don't know, because this is like...
We don't.
Yeah, but she's kind of like the crab feeder part two, where you've heard so much about her, and then you finally get to see her, and then she's dead. She's dead at Daemon's hands before you know it.
Yeah. I do feel like the more you get to know Daemon, the less you like him, though. That's just my opinion of the guy after 5 episodes, because I'm liking him less and less.
I also like the dawning realization that she has, where she's like taunting him and saying, oh, what are you here for? Are you going to strike down the child that stands before you in the throne? And then she starts realizing, oh, shit.
The play here is to kill me and then go marry her.
Yeah, it's too late. We talked about this. I did a couple other background details. I'm unsure of how this geography works, because I'm looking at a map of the Vale and the Runestone is along the coastline south of the Fingers, which are these little narrow peninsulas that, you know, Littlefinger got his name from having a minor holding in those. And the Eyrie and the Bloody Gates, which is the path that kind of protects the Eyrie, where I think she's murdered here. Mm-hmm. That's the exact same location, but I would think that would be a heavily patrolled and guarded route, and they're making this seem out to be really remote. So maybe they're just like, we're going to shoot in the same spot, but we're not going to try to, like, you know, remind people that this is the exact same location. Maybe that path is really long and has a lot of similar, or maybe I'm just completely misreading the geography. Because we did see the Runestone when we went to see the Bronze Royce in the old series, and it looks remarkably similar. It's got a lot of, you know, it looks like they use the exact same model. It's very similar features, but like, I just don't know. It seems like way more than just a morning's ride to get from the Runestone to anywhere near where she got murdered at. But The other thing is, I really dug the way they interpreted this bronze runic armor that they wear. You know, that it's like more of like bronze plating over like this boiled leather kind of coat, and it's studded with all these different runes. And there's the Royces believe that that runic armor protects them such that they cannot be slain while they're wearing it.
Hmm.
And in Fire and Blood, there's kind of like a parenthetical maester laughing up a sleeve, observing that despite the fact that several Royces have perished on the battlefield while wearing their bronze runic armor, and we see in this episode, it doesn't offer protection from horse-based paralysis nor rocks smashed in the face. So mm-hmm. I'm with the maesters. The protective qualities of runic armor, dubious at best.
Totally. All right, let's go over to.
Oh, one scene. Other thing. Do you know what the house words for Royce are?
No.
We remember. Okay. And they also they're one of the older, like very northern based Blood of the First Men houses. You think of House Stark, you know, or the North remembers the phrase. That's not the words of House Stark, but that's the words of the. What do you think if you were Daemon and you're essentially raging a private war against this house, is that a grudge they're going to soon forget?
Doesn't sound like it, but
we'll see.
Who knows if Gerald dies and then, you know, the other people are like, yeah, maybe we should forget this. All right. Quick scene here where the king gets sick while sailing. We don't really know where he's sailing yet, but you can guess. I thought maybe he was just seasick at first. This is another kind of slow play in the episode. I'm like, maybe he gets seasick.
You know, I definitely think that's contributing to it for sure.
Probably, but over the course of the episode, he's just, yeah, feeling awful. He's got disease.
I did like, Lord Strong's, handing his hanky, and it reminded me of the classic phrase describing the king and the hand's relationship, that the king shits and the hand wipes. Literally, you know, the king sicks and the hand holds his hair back and mm-hmm. dabs the corners of his mouth with his pukey handkerchief.
All right. Alicent up at King's Landing doesn't want her father to leave, but he's gonna. Otto warns Alicent that the time is coming when Rhaenyra will have to kill her children to secure the throne, and that she needs to get out ahead of it. And then he's out, leaving her alone.
I mean, what is your take on this moral calculation he's doing? Do you think it is a foregone conclusion that the realm will reject Rhaenyra, and if they do, that she'll have to put her stepmother's family to the sword?
Can I say mildly interesting to all this? I know too much is the problem. I know storylines here, right? Like,
how did you? Is this the inadvised Wikipedia wikiing you did like a couple weeks ago? Is this the
no? This is just the rotten fruits premise of the rest of the show, right? This is just what the Dance of Dragons is.
But my answer is like is that a foregone conclusion, or is Otto bringing about the thing that he's most that he's fretting about? You know, that like if what is there a way for, because like he offers two courses of action. Uh-huh, you either get ready for war, or you, like I said on the podcast, you suck up to Rhaenyra like you've never sucked up to anybody, and you pray that she's merciful when the inevitable comes.
And like, you pray that she's strong enough when the inevitable comes, because it's not just that you have to win her favor and her mercy, but she's also got to win whatever battles are coming, whatever challenges are coming from the realm.
Right.
So you're both hoping that you pick the right side with Rhaenyra and hoping that she's merciful enough to let you live. I don't know. It's I think he's right on with his idea of what's coming. And those are really the only two options, right? Be with her or against her.
I like how they had Alicent raise the possibility that this is also partially your fault for pushing so hard to put, like, you know, that you every time you make Aegon a more attractive heir, you put a target more and more on our backs, and you make the other lords more and more inclined to do something crazy during the succession. But like I said, if he thinks that that's going to happen anyway, then you know, there's no statistical, there's no advantage to playing like what Allison's doing, which is kind of half-heartedly going, you know, just kind of like hoping that something will happen. She's got this grudge as she's nursing with Rhaenyra. But it seems like that this lit a fire under her to like, I have to figure out what's right and what's true. And unfortunately, everything she finds out is going to horrify and dismay her.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Laris here in a couple of scenes coming and like prodding her with this tea, this idea of tea that, you know, says basically, hey, Rhaenyra might have lied to you. That kind of really lights that fire under her. But yeah, I definitely think she's like reconsidering who she is going to be in all of this, what her role will be.
Yeah.
And it's pretty exciting, I will say. There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans.
That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
And now, back to Hot D. All right, let's move over to the king arriving at Corlys's castle. Is what is this called? I know that the place is Driftmark, right?
So this is, earlier in the season, I was given a breakdown of all the lords that talked about this, but this is on the island of Driftmark, which is just in from Dragonstone in the Blackwater Bay. He had a cat. There's a the ancestral castle of the Valyrians is called Driftmark, but I guess it's a cold, damp castle that was not to Corlys's liking. So when he came back from his world travels wealthy, he commissioned a brand new castle to be built called High Tide that more befits his hall. And it's on this narrow isthmus that at high tide you can only get to it on this narrow causeway, which was very well represented in on the screen. And it reminded me of that island the Jude Law visited in the third day.
Yeah, totally.
Except for this is like it never gets completely. It'd be badass if you had a fortification that you could only access a few hours of the day, but like it's the opposite. It's like, you know, it just wide enough for two horses and a carriage to fit through when it's at high tide.
And did that help with the dampness of the castle?
It seemed, I mean, I thought High Tide looked pretty tidy and warm for its location and where it's at. You know, you look at where, how shitty the out, I mean, there's rain and wind and all that kind of stuff. Inside it looked pretty nice.
Yeah, comparatively. So the Corlys doesn't come out to greet him, which would be customary. Instead, he waits for him in the throne room. Which is
Lord Strong is right to pitch a fit about this reception.
I mean, they're already like
calculated.
Like Rhaenys points out, he's already coming to them, which is a huge, kind of slap in his face.
Yes,
he's basically begging them to marry Rhaenyra, but like, this is also disrespectful. On top of that, and he's going to have this huge ask about the names later and what the heirs are going to be. He's disrespectful and he's got a huge ask to boot. It's like, boy, this guy's trying to take everything.
And it's calculated because I think he pushes Viserys right up to the point of insult and injury, which is not wise to do for the king. But
I
also
do wonder if this works if he's not as ill as he is, because he seems to just want this to be over, right? Like he wants to get out here. He's feeling like
He does not feel good. He wants a seat, but he doesn't want to appear weak. I thought it was funny that you pull up and Laenor and Joffrey Lonmouth are out there sword fighting. I don't know. Is that to me that read as a little bit of a joke, you know, because like sword fighting is kind of like frat boy type of behavior with male penises. I've given to understand. I've never engaged in sword fights myself in that manner, but
sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that they were kind of that was a little suggestive. These guys playing out in the yard.
For sure. I want to say they did something similar with Loras. Back in Game of Thrones,
the might have. Although, wasn't our interest? Our introduction to him was the mountain almost killing him, and then Brienne of Tarth handing him his ass. That's the opposite of sword fighting.
Okay,
that sword and catcher's mitting.
Okay. So then we go over to King's Landing again, where Laris Strong. Makes a pretty transparent attempt to manipulate Alicent by dropping the fact that Rhaenyra was given tea by the Grand Maester the night before, and it seems to work. It's so obvious, but, you know.
I was surprised at how many people leapt to the conclusion that Laris must have sent her the tea. I don't know what Laris's position and powers are at this point, but like, how would he possibly order the Grand Maester to make the tea? I think what they've suggested is that he is in with the ladies and he is an astute listener and observer, and there are probably people saw the Maester, you know, delivering, and that his ears were in a position to overhear that, to use the information. But I cannot imagine what in the world, like Larry Strong just bops up, or I guess hobbles up to the Grand Maester's like, hey, why don't you take this moon tea?
And it's from the king.
Say it's from this king. It's only got one purpose. So everyone that sees it knows you're making it is going to assume these things. But I think that it's more of like, you're supposed to be impressed by how well informed he is. More than he's got the pull to do something like that.
And I like that he doesn't name the tea specifically. He just lets her think about what tea that might be. He just says,
he's really fucking good. And he's even, you know, talking about, he's essentially at the beginning is like, you don't belong here. And I'm not sure if you're going to thrive here, but I know it's possible. But if you want to be one of these wildflowers growing, and you're going to probably need some allies, and you know, I'm at least giving you some information. That's lealish.
Yeah, and he knows, despite being the queen, and you know, she protests, "Well, I'm the queen. I have a ton of allies." Despite that, she actually doesn't. Right?
Her father's, we know, just that's left. Bullshit. From this previous episode, she says, she told Rhaenyra, "I'm all alone. I don't have anyone."
Yeah, so he's figured that out. And he picks the perfect time. Her father leaves. There's this doubt about Rhaenyra in her head. Yeah, it's well calculated, but it's a little transparent, in my opinion.
I will say for the Maester's Corner later in the week, I got a banger Valyrian steel foil theory about Laris, and it's something that. People put together the piece together. It's not what I would call a book spoiler. It's more informed speculation based on how the show has changed in relation to the book. But I'm really eager to discuss with the people who are lore aficionados like myself. A little mini spoiler edition, I guess, at the end of the Maester's Corner next in a couple days.
Okay, sounds great. Let's go over to Rhaenyra being barred from the throne room. That's Corlys's throne room, as Viserys meets with him to ask that Laenor and Rhaenyra be married. And a couple of things happen here. You know, Corlys tells the king that Daemon's wife is dead, which they didn't know yet. Mm-hmm. It seems apparent to me that neither Viserys or what's his first name? Lord Strong, the Hand.
Oh, God damn it. Lionel.
Lionel, yeah. Neither Viserys or Lionel believe that Rhaenyra's death was an accident. They both give knowing looks to each other.
They do such a good job of this showing and not telling. Like, we just saw Viserys puking his way across. Again, I cannot express how minor a sailing voyage. Like, they haven't even left the mouth of the Blackwater Bay. Or the protection of Blackwater Bay. Mm-hmm. King's Landing is at the mouth of the Blackwater Bay.
So like Driftmark from San Francisco to Alcatraz. Is
that, I mean, it's not that pathetic, but you're on the right track. It's much closer to that than L.A. to Honolulu. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
And he's puking his way across this very minor passage. And then they tell the story of this guy alone going through all these corridors. And he's just like all of this stuff that Corliss has got from sailing all the way around the world, this treasure, all this armor, these big frescoes painted of, you know, his ship, the Sea Snake, sailing this. And we later find out apparently he has half the dragons in the realm.
That's what he says.
House Valerian. I don't know about that math, but he's got the biggest fleet and half the dragons. And I think you're supposed to just feel this massive inferiority complex that will feed into his conversation with Lord Strong later on. And he's just it's probably been years since they've seen each other. Mm-hmm. I like Rhaenys going up to and holding his hands and feeling like one of the gloves is half empty and surmising that he's not well, and him finding out about probably his brother's done something stupid. Like, they do such a good job of just, this is all subtext, you know?
Yeah. No, totally. And there's some big asks here. I talked about the names. Corliss wants his kids to have the name Valerian when they take the throne. Viserys says, nah, but they can have it temporarily when they're born.
And this isn't just ego for him, because he sincerely believes that a Targaryen must sit the throne to save the world.
Sure.
Corliss is just out for his own glory. But like, even if he was inclined to be that, you know, self-effacing, he literally is like, I can't do it, buddy. It'll doom the realm. But he can't say that.
Right. And I think that's an interesting, you know, contrast between them. You talked about the contrast of like Viserys being kind of a do nothing king sitting on the throne, pondering his legacy at the end and going, did I do anything? No.
Yeah.
And then Corliss, who's out there, you know, conquering the world on boats. Here it's the other way around, right? Like, Corliss is so worried about his own stature and his own place in the world and that idea that he's going to be a world conqueror and that his kids will inherit that. And he doesn't know that it's what he's doing here, but Viserys is worried about the opposite, right? He wants to keep peace in the realm. He wants to make sure that the kingdoms aren't destroyed by whatever's coming in this prophecy. I think there's a lot of duality here between the two guys. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Another thing I was wondering about in this scene is, you make the point that they haven't seen each other in a few years. There's still, obviously, Corliss is holding that sort of grudge that he held about the Stepstones and not being listened to and all this. Does it do anything to smooth that over? And does it help seal this deal that Viserys has let Otto go as Hand of the King? Does Corliss see that and go, okay, maybe that's an admittance that I was actually right, and he appreciates that fact?
Or is
there any chance at all that he turns this down? Because I don't think so. I think this is Corliss's wet dream. But
yeah, I think so. And I was studying their faces to see if this was some kind of dig, but I honestly think that I think Corliss really likes Lord Strong, and they were simpatico on the council in a way that, you know, Otto was always the one like trying to dismiss his claims and move the king on to like, oh, feasting and tourneys, my lord, isn't that much more interesting than to talk about the shit in the Stepstones? I think that he sees this as a upgrade, and it wasn't anything more than that. It's just respect for Lord Strong.
Oh, yeah. I was meaning, like, does Corliss see, you know, Otto's dismissal as an acknowledgement that he was right all along, I guess.
Oh, does he? Well, I guess, yeah, it must be an open secret that Otto was the one that brokered that deal. And he's the one that stood the most to gain by it.
I'm
trying to get, what do you mean by he was all right all along?
Oh, that Otto was, you know, essentially manipulating the king out for his own interests and not concerned about the Stepstones because that wasn't what interested him, right?
Gotcha.
Power
okay.
was what interested him. And Corliss has been saying the whole time, these Stepstones are a problem, king.
Yeah.
And the king was ignoring him because of Otto's advice. But now that he's dismissed him, maybe Corliss thinks, okay, the king has seen the error of his ways and admitted that I was right all along, so I'm more inclined to go along with this marriage proposal.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good take too. And like, I think you could be forgiven to believe that maybe Corliss was pursuing his own interest, because like, who's hurt the most from the Stepstones, you know, being a problem? Well, it's him. He owns all the shipping over there. But mm-hmm. like, I think that they, in later episodes, they showed like in episode 3 during the hunt, it seemed like that was hurting a lot of the realm. You know, it was getting to be a bigger, like Corliss is dead on that this is something that we should have nipped in the bud instead of waited till where it starts affecting more than just me.
Yeah. Is there a stage one of step one of the 3-step Martin reveal here where, or was the killing of Rhea step one and this is step two, where Rhaenys specifically mentions that Lady Rhea stood to inherit Runestone in this scene?
And
then later we'll find out that
this is all very mildly interesting, but we'll see. Cause I know the answer one way or another about this inheritance thing. And it wouldn't be sporting to just tell you.
I won't have to hunt that information.
Plus like, it's also one of those details that like, I could see them swerving, on the show. So, because they've done, like I said, this episode, they did a lot of that. You know, it's like, I won't say they break canon, but the show is playing a little loose with when things happen and what order things happen and like, what is the inflection and the exact kind of tenor of the things that happen. So.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing about this scene I really liked is just the set decoration. Corliss has all these trinkets from the places he's been, the battles he's fought. Like you said, in the instant take, the crab feeder helmet mask.
I think that's exactly what it is. That is his latest trophy from his conquest.
Yeah. That's mounted up here. You've got, much like Viserys has, a model of some castle. I'm still not sure which one it is.
I thought that was cool too, that they're like modeling bros.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Was that like the architectural design for High Tide? Cause it kind of shared that like rough Was it maybe Driftmark, you know, the actual ancestral seat that he has just kind of set up in his new digs, the show respect for his forefathers. It was cool that they both
every morning remind him how dank it was. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to lay it. It's look at the standing pools of water.
Right.
Yeah, no, I thought that was really cool. That shows that, you know, maybe in another life that him and Viserys could have been BFFs.
And then over on the other side of the throne, and these are just a few of the things, but he's got this gigantic Nautilus shell, which is super cool.
I guess I was leaning towards that being treasure because it's gilded. But on the other hand, they could just give gilded it. You know, like sure. It could be like just an enormous. And I thought like, you know, what's a huge Nautilus, like a Nautilus that size, you could call a Kraken easy. And like, is that like what's all left? Right. And they just gilded it. Or was that like just this massive thing that did he steal this from the Sea Lord of Braavos or something? Like, it's a cool piece of it's cool. It's something cool to speculate about.
Yeah. I continue to love his interior decorating style.
Yeah.
All right, let's move over to Rhaenyra and Laenor walking on the beach, coming to an agreement to marry, but to continue, as they put it, dining as they see fit, which means essentially taking other lovers. Because Laenor's tastes, I can't remember if he's for the goose or the duck, but whatever it is, it's not her taste.
Yeah, I think this is a deliberate homage to the classic scene in Spartacus between Laurence Olivier and Tony Curtis, where Olivier is playing the master of Tony Curtis, who's playing a Roman slave, and he's trying to feel him out about, because it turns out he's bisexual, and mm-hmm. he's trying to ask him about, like, you know, do you honor the gods? Do you lie? And, like, you know, you do that because, like, there's a moral conviction, right? It's like, well, do you eat oysters? When I can find a master. Do you eat snails? I don't like snails. Is one a moral choice or another? No, I suppose not. It's just a matter of taste, right? I like snails and oysters. And it's a very circumspect way, because I think what's interesting is it gives Laenor the room to be like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Sure.
You know, like he could, but like also
it's tactful.
But also if cause like, again, in the books, this is kind of like not quite an open secret, but wide speculation that like, huh, this guy doesn't seem to take any interest in women. He always surrounds himself with comely young men. God, I hate that word, comely.
I know. I try to.
Isn't this the grossest? It's like, Corliss anyway,
says it in this episode.
He does about Rhaenyra, how she's gotten more comely of late. But they say that, and it's like it gives him the room. First of all, maybe Rhaenyra is wrong because if it's an open secret, it's still a secret. Maybe Laenor doesn't want to come out that way, or maybe he's bisexual instead. So I thought this was a pretty tactful way for this young woman to handle the situation and, you know, try to get what she wants out of this deal. And Laenor, like
she uses this to not place blame too, right? This analogy is very similar to sexuality because you don't know why you like goose over duck.
Yeah,
it's just that's how you feel about it, right?
It's just a matter of taste.
She gives him that out too, where she's like saying without saying it, but she's not trying to shame him for that. And I like that.
Yeah, and they also show that, like, unlike Sir Criston Cole, who, when he hears this plan, he gets more and more angry, like, there's this smile that slowly spreads on Laenor's face when he realizes what she's offering him. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of, like, I guess, hurt feel. Like, they start the scene with Laenor and Joffrey here in a minute where he's kind of brooding about it, but it doesn't last very long because even, you know, maybe he was only brooding because he thought Joffrey would be pissed. But when Joffrey's like, you know, this is kind of best case scenario, bro.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think was going to happen here?
Yeah. Like, we could sneak around for the rest of our lives, but like, yeah, we can live at court and I can be your sworn protector and nobody mm-hmm. will bat an eye about me staying in your quarters all night long. And yeah, again, it's like, I hope I don't come across as being like, it's okay to be in the closet if you've got, like, you know, this little in, you know, if you're like Liberace and you just keep adopting young men as your sons. Like, I don't think that's ideal. But in this particular situation, in this particular society, this is as close to a good deal as these men are probably going to get.
I also would not shame people for being in the closet either, because it's everybody's choice as to what they want to do.
Yeah, man, you got to protect yourself.
Comfortable, just do that. But like, yeah, totally. I think this is best case scenario for them in this world, for sure.
Yes.
And then we go back to the throne room where Rhaenys and Corlys talk about the deal they just struck with Viserys and Rhaenyra. And then they disagree about the danger that they might be placing their son in and whether his sexual orientation will be a problem. This is the scene where he says he has half the dragons and the navy, which is pretty freaking powerful.
Yeah, I thought it was on subsequent watches, because in between my first and second watch, among other things, I read an article that Kim Renfro wrote on The Insider, where she went in deep on the different principals and the directors and the cast, and they're like, and I don't know whether this is just them talking and we'll see how this plays out, but they're trying to make a civil rights point about why and how women are not respected in Westeros, and why you need it's more than just allies, and it's more than just people like on your like what does it take to make the societal change? And I thought it was really interesting the phrase that Corlys uses here about that he's willing to use, or he's willing to win this right for her by any means necessary, which when I hear that phrase, I think Malcolm X, you know, that we are looking for human dignity and to be treated as humans in society. And we will fight, you know, using any, I'm paraphrasing, like, yeah. I wouldn't have made that connection otherwise, but like, there is this, all this talk about this, they're trying to say something about gendered politics and dynamics in this world. And apply it to kind of our day, that my ears perked up on it, because otherwise I'm like, it feels like Rhaenys is like, are you sure this isn't for wealth and pride and power? Because we're putting our son in a massive amount of danger, which we'll see that mm-hmm. play out by the end of this episode. And he's like, no, this is about justice. This is about you being passed over and about this realm's constipation about women and all that kind of stuff. So we'll see how, I guess, down for the cause he is.
Yeah, I don't know how much I believe him in that regard. I mean, when he's haggling over the names of his heirs and he's displaying all these fortunes he's won,
right?
Yeah, I don't know what kind of guy Valerian is here, but
also he's talking crazy with this. Oh, just wait until my son gets a taste of the poon, man. It's just going to like change that.
It's the
unique pleasures of being inside a woman will just completely fucking rewire you. It's going to be fine. And she's like,
eating a goose. Well, I like duck, dude. Come on.
I find duck is very greasy, Jim. And it's like Rhaenys is like, shut the fuck up. Are you be serious about it? And to his credit, he stops that shit right quick. But
the other interesting like wrinkle in this, I guess, is that Rhaenys is saying she doesn't even care about this slight anymore, where she was passed over for the throne because she's a woman.
Which, that's bullshit, right?
I think that's got to be at least a little bullshit.
She might have gotten used to the insult or, you know, used to bearing it, but it still stings. There's no way it doesn't. Just the way she carries
it. It lends a little bit more of a performative quality to what Corlys is saying here. Like, he's going to right a wrong.
Yeah.
If the person who was wronged doesn't even care about the wrong anymore, is it right to go right it? You know, I don't know. It's a question that can be asked, but it certainly puts a lot less urgency into the matter, I think.
No, it reminds me of The Last Duel. You know, that was a part, the woman who supposedly wrongs, like, look, I don't want any more shit to happen.
You're stirring it's the men, pot, man. Stop it.
It's the men that is like, no, this can't. And you know, it's like at some point, yeah, like, who are you out for justice for? Is this, are you avenging the honor of your wife? Or is this actually your honor that's been tarnished? And you're by your lights. So I thought that, because again, you know, when the realm goes to war, it's a lot of women and children suffer uniquely in the most. So
sure.
It seems like they should have a say on what kind of banners get called and what kind of, if it's going to be done in their name, right?
You would think so. Yeah. All right. Let's go back over to Laenor, where his lover, Joffrey Lonmouth, and I don't know if I want to call him by his last name, because Joffrey is such a loaded name in this universe. Every time I say Joffrey, I kind of wince, but this guy doesn't seem too bad. Joffrey Lonmouth, they talk about his new arrangement with Rhaenyra. Joffrey makes a play to be Laenor's sworn protector and wonders who Rhaenyra's paramour might be.
Yeah, we pretty much discussed the scene already. This is the one fatal thread is that Joff thinks he's going to be clever by finding this out and making sure they have an understanding, and it's going to... Well, it's going to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. By the end of the episode, their conversation here juxtaposed with last scene, really brought into clear display here, what this episode and what a lot of these episodes and maybe this whole series has been about and is going to be about. I just noticed like them, you know, these lords thrusting their children into these dangerous scenarios where the kids are just completely lost. They're not prepared for this. They have no idea what's going on. They don't know how to navigate these waters. And then that turning around and hurting the adults too, you know, like this idea that people's expectations for their children just end up destroying families and society at large.
Yeah. And like, it goes down to our day, you know, like there's a lot of kids crushed by expectation.
Right. No, that's what I mean. It's something that, it seems like a bad idea all around. It's putting a lot of expectations on your kids. But
yeah,
what do I know?
It's more of just like support and nurture what's there and not try to make them feel like you are uniquely brilliant with gifts that only you can provide the world. And if you don't give 110% every day, you're a fucking failure. Yeah, no, that seems like it's psychotic.
Yeah, and trying to, you know, fulfill your self through their success is also a bad idea, right? Like, using them as tools in a power game you're playing is such a colossally bad idea, because they are, A, not you, and B, they're just... All these kids are so much more careless than the adults are, right? The adults have been creating these lives for decades, and the kids don't know any better, and they're thrown into these complex situations and end up just stepping on landmines. like Joffrey here in this episode steps into a situation he thinks he understands, but it is so far outside of what he knows. He ends up dead. It's crazy.
Well, that's the rub. If I put my dad hat on, what always scares me most as a parent is seeing my kid make the same mistakes I do, because he is so much like me, and it's very gratifying. But also that means he shares a lot of my weaknesses, and I've had, 40 plus years compensating for those weaknesses, and I try to share him. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, but like at the end of the day, kids are going to do, because you know all the mistakes you made and the ways that you got hurt.
Oh yeah.
And you're wanting, and you want them to avoid all that. But on the other hand, like, you are the person that you are because you went down those paths and made those mistakes, and you wouldn't mm-hmm. listen to. So like, it's like, and the other side of the parent is like, every once in a while, they're going to do something that's going to get them killed or really hurt bad in a way that maybe you weren't. You were maybe lucky. So like, I get the almost desperation of wanting your kids to do better than you, but it's,
it just seems a lot of times like a
monkey paw situation where you wish to avoid, and you create the very thing that you're trying to avoid.
Yeah. And, let's say they are somewhat like you and they manage through your guidance to avoid a lot of the pitfalls that you fell into. Well, they'll find all new ones to fall into. Right.
Right.
Because A, they're not you exactly. And B, they're not living in the same place or time that you did. So there's plenty of different stuff they can fall into that you just were never even challenged with.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else in that scene, or let's go over to the...
No, let's move on. There's still lots of hot D to talk about. We'll be back right after the break.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
A
And now, back to Hot D.
All right, we're on the boat back to King's Landing. Kristen asks Rhaenyra to give up the throne and run away with him. She declines, which, obviously. But it's incredibly hurtful because he broke his oath thinking it meant something, but clearly it does not mean as much to her as it did to him.
Yeah, it's like, why? It seems like, so Rhaenyra is a little naive in an interesting direction, because previously she didn't think that this stuff was possible and Daemon opened her eyes. And then when she went to seduce Kristen Cole, she thought, oh, maybe everyone is just morally flexible and we can just do this. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, like if it's so easy to resolve a love triangle that you just say, you know what, let's just open the relationship. Let's just make this a polycule. But that doesn't work for a lot of people. A lot of people are like, nah, fuck you. You need to make a choice. You need to choose this or that. And her thinking that Kristen Cole was morally flexible enough to set aside his vows and have sex with her, whereas he interpreted that as, no, I'm actually going all in. This is me pushing all my moral chips in the ground, and this means something.
Yeah.
Whereas, and then their confusion, because he's like, well, why don't you abandon your responsibilities and duties? And she's like, well, because like literally the fate of the world depends on it. Mm-hmm. She's like, well, why don't you just compromise? You know, like, you've already compromised. Why don't you just keep doing it? And he's like, it's, you know, like I said, it's hard to feel sorry for Sir Criston Cole because of the uniquely brutal thing that he does at the end of this episode. But like, mm-hmm. I can certainly understand his feeling of hurt and betrayal.
Oh, yeah.
You know, especially keep in mind the relatively youth and the world he's living in does not make what he did. But like, I understand how this is going, like this love and adoration is going to be twisted into disdain and hate.
And I feel like maybe if he caught her with this conversation, maybe if they had hooked up earlier when she was still on this, nah, I'm not getting married trip. And he had brought her this proposal, she might have run off with him, because this is what she wants, I think. And it's just maybe she doesn't want it with him. She wants it with Daemon.
Well, also, here's the other thing. I think as his sworn protector, he's been with her for years intimately, and he knows probably to a fact that she has not had sex with anybody. Right.
I guess. And
like,
so, yeah.
So I think he could be forgiven for thinking that like this was as special to her as he thought it was, that he perceived it to him. Like, oh, my God, she's giving me her maidenhood. This is like, you know, this like, hey, well, we're going to sell the Essos. I'm going to be a sellsword, my lady, and I'll support you. And we'll have oranges and cinnamon and all. And it's, you know, like I said, it's naive in a different direction from her naivety. That's like, oh, well, everybody's going to be as worldly as my uncle, because that's what I've got as an example, versus he's really traditional and conservative in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, I think this is one of the best scenes of the episode. And I think the dialogue is crisp. It doesn't rely on, you know, like some of the stuff that they do later in the episode with Alicent, kind of prying this secret inadvertently out of him. Mm-hmm. They play a little loose with the dialogue there to get that confession. Here, everybody is saying what they feel and think, and they're expressing it in ways that make sense for them. And I just love it.
It's also such a domino thing, too, because like, you wonder if he would have shit the bed on that confession so hard had he not had this conversation just moments before. You know, like this hurt and despair and him kind of like swimming. And like, I thought this, I forget this guy's name, the guy to play Sir Crispin dialogue by Sir Crisp here, that he plays like, you know, his eyes are like shining with tears, they're brimming with tears. He's a tough guy. And he's not going to let him show. But like, he is genuinely hurt here. And I think when Allison hits him with the, hey, do you know anything about, you know, Rhaenyra having, yeah, I did it. It was me. Like he was primed for that. If there was like a month in between that, maybe he pulls his shit together, but he's already feeling so guilty. And like, he threw away, he's like, this white cloak was the only thing I had to my name. Mm-hmm. And I threw it away. And I thought that we could, Fabian Frankel's the guy that gives the performance, that I thought that if I married you and we had this like happy ever after away from the scandal, that it would redeem it in some way. And now it's like, so like the conclusion is like, well, now he's irredeemable.
Yeah.
Which, if you start feeling that you're irredeemable, that's when really evil shit can happen, man.
Yeah, which I love because it's hilarious that in the eyes of like the realm, Rhaenyra would be also irredeemable here, right? Like she's supposed to be this pristine, untouched wife for some lord. And so she sullied herself that way, but he's also sullied himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good. What a great scene. And the other thing I think here is you have to remember the Daemon factors into this whole equation. There's a brief moment, and you can blink and miss it here, but when he first comes up to her and starts talking to her, her mind starts to wander in the middle of their conversation. And she sort of looks off to the side. He's talking about, you know, the sex they had or whatever. And then he says her name and she like snaps out of her daydream. Like she's been thinking about Daemon the entire time while he's been talking about that.
Interesting.
Which obviously she was probably thinking about him during it when it actually happened. So,
because that's the other thing is like, I didn't get the idea that Rhaenyra like she was literally going to be her boy toy. Like this is this like girlish fantasy of, oh, my white knight, my sworn protector and my secret lover in the sheets. But clearly she's infatuated with Daemon, too. And if Daemon came by and like crooked his finger and she didn't have her obligations to the realm, she'd probably. So it's like it's not even that like Kristen feels like he's got like some kind of special relationship that way, too. It's just it's just a real letdown for, I think, everybody. She's disappointed that he's kind of like this uptight about it and she can't have all of her cake and eat it too, because you know, like, it reminds me of like, what did she want to do? I just want to fly away and eat cake all day. That's what Sir Kristen Cole is, as a nice piece of angel food cake, and she wants it. She wants to have it and eat it too,
and all he's got is oranges. Can't make cake out of oranges.
Not even a good lemon cake. You got an orange cake? No. Who the hell eats an orange cake? Ugh.
No one.
Too cinnamony.
All right, let's go over to Allison watching Viserys from the keep as he arrives back at King's Landing and just collapses when he steps off the out of the cart.
And I love this because this is like the top, like when she sees him collapse, she startles like, oh, my God, my husband.
Yeah.
And then she, like she the rest of the episode
to help him. Right. But she's on the balcony and like.
Yeah. Well, also, but also she's like, there's like this also kind of undercurrent of like, because that's what she's like, oh, I'm just this, I'm kind of like this guy's appendage. I wipe his sores. I let him use my body. I take care of his children. I do all this stuff. And now it's like she's going from, oh, my God, my husband, to like, oh, my God, my husband. And this is the scene where, like, you know, with Kristen Cole, where it's all going to start to change.
Yep. So she summons Kristen to her chambers to question him about Rhaenyra's indiscretions with Daemon. And he mistakes her intentions and accidentally confesses to breaking his oath with Rhaenyra. And Alicent chooses not to punish him.
Yeah. Well, for now, it seems. But yeah, but also by the end of the episode. But he's, I think that's the other thing is that she doesn't really say, I won't geld you and I won't kill you. She just dismisses him from her service. So I think that's the other reason he's like gulping like a fish throughout this episode is not only is he in a turmoil about Rhaenyra, he also has the fact that the queen knows his infidelities hanging over his head. Yeah, and on the Allison side, we touched on this in the, but like, this is her worst case scenario. It's like, oh my God. But we talked about that. It's like, this is like, sometimes you have experiences with your friends that or family that recontextualizes like what they're capable of. Like, I didn't think.
Yeah.
Like, she's like, maybe thought that Daemon could seduce her, or maybe she'd have a tryst with a handsome knight. But the fact that she's like, you know, like Allison, I think, thinks this is the tip of the iceberg. Like, oh my God. Like, what if everything that Mushroom says is true? Yeah, I've gone to bat for her. I got my father dismissed. I'm going to trust this woman with my fucking life, and she can't even trust me with the secret of her maidenhood. Like, you can see the betrayal, and like everything her father says now is coming back 10 times louder and at this this klaxon level. And she did. Just another great scene.
Yeah, absolutely. All this brought on by Larry Strong, which. I wonder what his play is here. Why is he in here stirring this pot? His father.
He's a second son. He has got a physical deformity, which means he probably can't distinguish himself in battle. To me, I'm actually really excited because this is Jaime and Tyrion, with maybe even better. You know, like Harwin possibly is to Jamie. He's the brawn.
Sure.
You've got Laris as the brains. Like this is something that Martin likes doing a lot. You know, pairing physically weak people. Like this is Oberyn and Prince Martell. You know, Oberyn's the dashing. He's the serpent with the flashing fangs, and Daemon is the snake in the grass. Like he likes this dichotomy of strength and you know, average or dim-witted intelligence. Hodor and Bran versus cunning and, yeah, and physical weakness. Uh-huh. And those have been always historically really fun pairings. And this one might be like that. But like, yeah, like what else is he going to do? Like, if you're not invited to speak,
but
you listen.
What is this intended to provoke? I mean, it seems to me like this could potentially be the first cracks in Lionel Strong's loyalty to the realm. Because like, I can't imagine he's doing this autonomously. I feel like,
oh, you think
he would have Lionel's to be talking to his father about the meddling he's doing, right? Because he's the king. This is he's deeply invested in this realm. And if Lionel thinks that Aegon is the best potential heir here, this could be a backdoor way into, you know, getting Rhaenyra ousted as heir, getting into the queen's attention. I don't know. I'm trying to just follow the logic. Where does this chain lead? Well, it leads to Rhaenyra and Alicent becoming enemies. And Laris knows that.
But surface, because like this is probably the first time, you know, the Laris has not been around court very much. You know, it's this impression I got. That he's offering Alicent an ally, but he's kind of also fishing for one. Like, boy, it'd really be nice to have the favor of the queen in my back pocket. And that he's a guy who's just like, well, how can I distinguish myself? He's a Littlefinger type.
Sure.
But he's
doing
it
by sowing dissent among the queen and the heir to be. So I feel like if that is not a play to get the heir ousted as heir, then it's foolish.
Yeah.
But that's just my opinion, man.
Yeah. A lot of people pointed out the fact that if you take Littlefinger and Varys's name and put them together, you get Laris. And there's a lot of similar like motivations and styles here of accumulation of favors and secrets and listening more than you talk. And, you know, to what end is, and then that's the question is like, is he going to be a Varys type that's doing it for the realm and for the good of everybody? Is he going to be a Littlefinger type doing it for his own personal interest?
Yeah. And how will Harwin and Lionel figure into his dealings?
Because it looks like the brothers have a good relationship, right?
Talking or get to know more about them. They do seem like they have a good relationship.
Yeah, they're kind of like talking, whispering each other about what all the queen's dress means, and we've seen them eating at the table, and it seems like they don't hate. It's kind of like Jaime and like Tyrion that there's not a lot of enmity here.
I've never seen them talk with their father. I want to know what that relationship is like.
Yeah, that would be good to know.
Yeah. I don't know, man. We'll see. I feel like we need a new bald move rule. It must be like 16 by now. Bald move rule 16. Always, always make them make you say it when you have a secret. Never volunteer information that they have not proven they already know. And even if they prove it, maybe just deny it anyway.
Yeah, those of us with strict sort of parents learned that at the age of 12 or 13. But yeah, apparently if you can grow up and be a Kingsguard and not know how to, you know, what do you got? What do you got? I want my lawyer.
Implications. I want my lawyer. Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
I mean, Damon's the expert at that, right? Like he shows you how it's done. Like even turn around to an accusation. Are you confessing to something? My queen, do you have a guilty conscience?
Or just don't say anything. Just stone face through the entire conversation. Let them hang themselves with their own doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. The Little shaggy 16. Defense. It just wasn't me. No matter what. It just wasn't me.
Yep. All right. Let's go over to Viserys. He's feeling terrible. So the Maester readies the leeches, as he does. Viserys then asks Lionel Strong what his legacy will be. Turns out, not much, but that might not be such a bad thing.
Yeah. I thought this was another great scene. I really like Patty's portrayal of Viserys as this man. And this is, man, this is such a great, well-constructed episode, because everything adds to it. Like, his walk of insecurity through Corlys's house that, like, he built from nothing. It, literally, like, he's the only, like, he mentioned this, I'm the only one that's made my own goddamn castle of all the great lords of Westeros right now living. Yeah. And he's walking through that, and now he's been laid low, and he's confessing to, I like how he calls him Lionel. Like, you know, it's very, like, he really trusts Lord Strong here in a way that he didn't trust Otto. And, you know, he asked him for his honest appraisal. And of course, you know, Lord Strong's, you know, he's not going to be like, oh yeah, you'd be Aegon reborn or anything. He's just like, you know, a lot of people in your situation would count their fortune. You know, you haven't been tested. Times have been good. But also, I kind of relate to that, to like, man, you kind of do want to be tested. You want to see what you're capable of. And if you are never able to do that, and, you know, now you see the better parts of your life are behind you, like, that's got to eat at you. And it's eating at him as much as the disease is.
Yeah. Is this Leal? Is it Leal to not even give your dying king platitudes when he asks about his legacy?
I think so. I think that that's like what Otto said about the hand's like obligation to tell the truth and keep it 100 is true. And I think Lionel's doing that a lot better than Otto did.
Yeah, he needed to be advising Viserys all along. And I feel like Viserys might feel better about his own legacy had that been true.
Do you think that the Grand Maester Melis here is sandbagging the king? This is something that came up on the instant talk portion of our podcast. People ask, like, do you think the younger Maester, you know, he's just wanting to leech. The king gets sicker and sicker and sicker. Also, I came away much more convinced than on my first watch that you're not supposed to understand that his whole hand is rotting away. I think you're supposed to understand that his whole arm is caked with some kind of herbal poultice mixture. Yeah. When you first see it, it's like, holy shit, this thing looks like it's about to fall off.
Yeah, it looks bad. Grayscale times 10. The younger maester here says, like, I have a different herbal poultice that I'd like to try. So it's clear they are trying one currently, but it's just not doing much. I think it's just laced with weed, right?
Yeah. It's not going to really help, but you'll feel better about it.
And then he won't have to drink the sleeping potion. Yeah.
True.
It'd be good. All right. The royal wedding celebration begins with a feast. I am going to split this up into two sections here.
Before you go on, though, there's a brief scene where the Valyrians are coming to court across the Blackwater Bay.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, like, because I thought this was Laenor and Laena. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck this red dragon is. I don't know why I think it's because I just don't see color, Jim. I especially don't see the color when the white woman's face is about 5 pixels on my television screen. But okay. This was a Laenor and Rhaenys. Rhaenys's dragon is known as the Red Queen, Melis. Oh. And it's this brilliantly scarlet dragon with pink wing membranes. And she's supposed to be very fast and swift, one of the swifter dragons. Larger than Sea Smoke too, about twice the size of Sea Smoke.
Yeah, no, it's badass. I'm really getting the vibe between Rhaenys and Corlys. They both seem like kick ass, take no prisoners kind of people. They feel like a great match to me.
Yeah, they're very much a Han Solo Princess Leia combo.
Yeah,
one really 1-2 punch of just fucking red belted top tier power couple.
Yep, pretty awesome. So we go to the royal wedding celebration, beginning with a feast. The lords each make a more audacious entrance than the last, including Daemon, and then Allison tops them all by interrupting the king's speech with her entrance. And I'll stop there. Maybe we can talk about this.
How about Rhaenyra's hair? I don't usually comment on this stuff, but like, I could not get over the braiding and the jeweledness of it all. Like, it is exquisite.
Oh, I didn't notice. Yeah.
It's carved out of platinum, set on her head.
Nice. Is it possible? I'm going to go with a crazy theory here. that this is all a dream happening in the king's head as he passes out, because his eyes close and we smash cut to this. And the shit that happens in this last scene is so insane, I feel like it has to be a dream.
Also, that chandelier that's made out of like all these wild fowls is like floating in the middle. It looks like, every once in a while, these kids will read the Bible and come across a biblically accurate description of an angel. And I feel like that's what it looks like. It's like this is like this fucking thing that just sprouting wings and eyes, and it might have wheels and then wheels. And it did look like something out of a Lars von Trier movie. just hovering over the whole proceedings. They're very ominous and weird. But you could talk me into this all being a dream. I think it would lead to outrage amongst the fan base, but that's fun. Oh, that's sometimes fun too.
Yeah, I'm kidding, obviously. But the game of entrances they're playing here, I love it. It's the way it escalates, right? It's like, first you get the high towers and the Lannisters walking in, and the announcer's like, "And this is the Lannister guy. His name's Jason, whatever. He's
the you got giant high tower ass, yeah. too." Mm-hmm.
And then the wedding party arrives, right? The Valyrians. And they get the full announcement. They get the standing ovation. Uh-huh. And then Daemon walks in right behind him. And you're like, all eyes on him. A hush in the room. Oh, my God. He's here. What the hell?
Yeah.
And that's not even the biggest entrance.
Unannounced.
Allison tops them all by interrupting the king. Everybody is like one-upping each other with their entrances here. It's so good.
And like, I wonder how many people in the hall got the significance of this.
The green that dress.
This is the queen kind of going into battle mode.
Yeah, she's going to war with Rhaenyra. I don't know. It'd be tough without being privy to all the info we have, but...
But just a social faux pas of her walking in late and walking all over her king's wedding speech, commencement speech.
And the way she walks in, too. This is a very different Allison. I think the person playing Allison here does a great job commanding that room and showing the different energy that she has now that she has decided which side she's on here.
Yeah. Indeed.
It's very just, you feel it in the room. Of course, Jason stepping in it again. I mean, he's always stepping in it. He's talking about women never being ready for the battle. Just a bad joke to begin with, but doing it right in front of the heir to be, who is a woman, is ridiculous.
If only Brienne of Tarth are here to split him in half with her bare hands.
And then later he rolls his eyes when Laenor kisses Rhaenyra's hand, like,
oh, he wants to be in this position. Ugh. Yes, it's exits. He's he's changing his Lannister gold for green of envy. It's my read on that.
And Rhaenyra, there are two reads being done here, right? I think there's the read that Joffrey does of Kristen and how that's Rhaenyra's paramour, but I think Rhaenyra gets the connection between Laenor and Joffrey as well. She sees them making eyes. It's conspicuous that they let us know that she notices. Mm-hmm. So I think she's aware of what the events of this evening are going to mean to Laenor.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I there's a lot of significant glances around a lot of people in these scenes.
Totally.
It's kind of fascinating to watch from a people perspective.
Do you want to talk about everything that happens after the dancing begins?
I will say another mea culpa. I thought that the dwarf that they had in the band banging on the drums, I said there's no way that could be Mushroom, but per Patty Considine, that is explicitly intended to be Mushroom. And it's something that he says was his call, which I'm not sure if it's a joke, because it's kind of like I got this from Kim Renfro again from her insider reporting. And she mentioned that if I'm reading this like Fire and Blood, I'm like, I don't know if Patty was, because he's like, don't tell Ryan Condal or don't listen, don't let him insist otherwise. But this was, I read Fire and Blood and I loved Mushroom and I wanted him to be in at least one scene. But now he's been in one scene. I do wonder if they're just going to keep him in the background as a nod to the fans, or if we'll get to see more of his, unique perspective on the proceedings.
I will say he didn't look that foolish to me.
Yeah, they definitely.
I love his style. He's got like a Claudio Sanchez kind of look to him.
Yeah, yeah. I dug it too, and he's handy with the he's really banging those bongos. But I think they definitely down like it was a tasteful mushroom, if one could say such a thing exists.
Sure. All right, the dancing begins, and boy, the knives come out. Gerald Royce accuses Damon of killing his wife Rhea. Damon flirts with Lena for a bit, and then Rhaenyra provokes him into almost banging her right on the dance floor. And Joffrey Lonmouth makes it clear to Kristen that he knows his secret, which sends Kristen into a rage. Kristen murders him in front of everyone, throwing the hall into chaos, and then runs off. Oh, and if that weren't enough, also Viserys starts bleeding from his nose, and nobody notices because of the chaos in the hall, right? I feel like that's his saving grace here, is nobody saw him bleeding.
Yeah, Bobby B would let this happen in his hall. He would have gotten up and silenced the hall with a hearty "Cease this nonsense in the name of your king," and everybody would stop because people pay attention when the hammer starts talking. Viserys is just helpless. He's just literally the Kingsguard is surrounding him. He doesn't know what to do. He's desperate for Rhaenyra. I love Lionel. Letting Harwin off the leash, and he just like, God damn it. I watched his scene so many times because he literally parts that crowd like Moses' staff does the Red Sea. He's grabbing guys by the shoulder, flinging them to the side. Anyone gets his way, friend or foe, just punch in the face, you're down, punch in the face, you're down. Grabs Rhaenyra. She's protesting the entire time as he bodily carries her off to safety. Yeah. What a fucking Chad, man. I am totally pro Harwin.
Me too.
What a beacon of positive masculinity. Loves a blood-soaked Rhaenyra carrying in a gutted boar. Catches Rhaenyra red-handed traipsing about the King's Landing with her uncle. Does he say anything? Does he betray her confidence? Next time he sees her, does he treat her like she's a skank or a whore? No, he's got a smile. He wants to dance with her. Like, I'm, this fucking pro Harwin podcast right here.
Oh boy. There's so much to talk about here. I guess we're right in the action already. The great thing to me about this whole scene, the best point of this entire scene is when they're cutting over to Viserys and he's looking out across the heads in the room. And he can't really see much of anything. He sees like glimpses of Daemon and Rhaenyra talking. And it's clear that something's going on there and he's concerned about it. And they do a shot to Viserys where he is just sawing at a lobster with a knife and a fork and paying no attention to what he's doing.
I had a crab feeder joke that he's actually feeding on the crab. He's a crab. He's the new crab feeder. It could be a crab,
but his look, he's just like gazing out across the room, eyes bulging out of his head at what he's seeing with Daemon and Rhaenyra.
Yeah.
Sawing away at a crab and nobody's paying him any attention. I love it. That needs to be a gif. That's a meme right there for sure.
Let's talk about other things. Sir Gerald Royce bops up and does this ill-advised, I want to hold you to justice. It's wrong place, wrong time. Damon essentially threatens him. It's like, not only are you not going to haul me off to justice, but I'm going to be paying you a visit on my dragon, and we're going to talk about my inheritance of the runestone. Mm-hmm. And I love Lord Strong is gulping that wine like Jesse Pinkman at that dinner party that the whites threw on Breaking Bad. Just like, he's just like, oh God, this is so awkward and comfortable. Who's going to die? I love that. Let's talk about Joffrey sidling up to Sir Criston Cole.
Yeah. Steps into something a situation he doesn't fully understand.
Yeah. And we talked about how, that he probably as a covert gay man in Westeros, him and Laenor are probably better than most at picking out subtle undercurrents and things happening and gazes and stuff. So he's able to I know who's the handsome person and I'm going to go square it. I still did not see any kind of deceit or threat. I thought it's more of like, we're going to be bros, right? And we're going to, I've got you, you've got me. It's not going to be any kind of, there's not a jealous bone in my body. I understand what's up. There's no threat here.
He gets like, if he said it with a little more sinister of a tone, I could see there being an implied threat when he says, secrets, if this secret stays a secret, all of our secrets stay secrets or something. It could be like if Littlefinger said this, it's a threat, 100%.
Or if a mafia don said, "Hey, this is a nice thing we got going. Shame if something happened." Like to me, what's the percentage? What's the percentage in that?
It's more like we both have secrets that we can, and we'll keep them together, right? Because we're both invested in this.
We're all in this, and I want to get in at the beginning saying that. I also privately thought it was hilarious that he goes, "They call me the Knight of Kisses, but I don't know why." Because literally the book just establishes that this guy is Joffrey Lawnman, called the Knight of Kisses, and they never explain. Usually when someone has a surname like Harwin Breakbones, it's because he's so big and strong, he breaks people's bones in tournament. Larys Strong, the Clubfoot, he's got a fucking clubfoot. Martin has no interest in explaining, like, the bronze bitch, well, she's a woman and she's bronze, and she got bronze armor. The Knight of Kisses is just like, who the fuck knows? And he dies a page later. So which we'll talk about.
I will say I did not think it was as big of a leap here on second watch for them to just immediately suss out that Kristen was hot for Rhaenyra.
Yeah.
Because if you look at, you know, the previous scene where Rhaenyra and Laenor were talking, she revealed that she also has other tastes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they already knew that she had some kind of paramour. He basically says it. Who is it, right? And so all they have to do is look across the room and see who's looking at Rhaenyra the most. And they can just assume. So it's not like that finely tuned secret sussing machine that I thought it was. It's more just like, we know there's something going on, let's just see who it is.
Also, there's the opposite where, like, when Laenor and Rhaenyra were dancing, he's literally the only one not watching them. He's like staring up at the ceiling because it's like literally pain. Yeah, yeah. So there's like both, like, he's stealing glances at her, and then when she's like dancing with her new husband in a sham marriage, he's deliberately looking away.
Well, why didn't they suspect Jason Lannister when he rolls his eyes at the kiss, the hand kiss?
Because he's too stupid to be considered for a paramour.
There's still lots of hot D left to talk about. We'll be right back after the break.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now back to Hot D. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Lena making a pitch to Damon. All
right. Yeah.
That is like, and you know, we talked about this in Insta Take. He's doing the like, I'm a bad boy. You sure you want to, you know, roll with me? Because I'm just going to hurt you. And she's like, yeah, well, I'm down with that.
Look, dude, I was going to be sold off when I was 12 to
the Sea Lord of Braavos.
Like, yeah. What do you think? Stranger to that. Yeah.
What do you think happened to that? Do you think that Corliss gets this better offer and now that's off the table, or?
I don't know. That's a really good question. Because I
wondered that myself.
Damon might be vying for her attention as well. You know, yeah. And not because he's into Elena or anything, just because he wants to kind of stick it to Viserys and also be close to the throne and like close to Rhaenyra in a weird way. I don't know. I see a lot of potential for for Damon and Lena to get together somehow.
So then as my man Harwin gets to finally dance with the princess, Damon rudely cuts in and starts talking shit about Laenor. And Rhaenyra is not having it. She's like, I've heard this is just a political arrangement. And if you don't like it, do something about it. You're its badass top five warrior of the Seven Kingdoms. You probably got a Valyrian steel something on you. Why don't you just slaughter all the bodyguards and carry me off to Dragonstone and make me your fucking wife, big shot. Mm-hmm. And then Daemon grabs her like by the hair and pulls her I thought he's going to roughly kiss her or something. Mm-hmm. And you can see Viserys like leaning forward, like, the lobster's getting sawed even faster. And then the crowd just kind of like, you know, like people dance in front of him and you hear the scream. Oh my God.
Because they've been planting seeds of this throughout the entire scene, right? This could be Royce attacking Daemon. This could be Jason attacking Laenor. This could be 15 different people in this room could want to attack somebody and you don't know who it is.
And just the technical art side of this, of like the amount of extras, the low level of lighting, that's still like, this is a very dark scene, but not like, you know, battle scene in season 8 of Game of Thrones dark. Like it's dimly lit, but you can see everything.
It's like Saul scene, right?
The amount of like direction and resetting you have to do on everything, the continuity of all the different dancers and like, it just must have been such a fucking challenge. It probably took a week, if not longer, to film these like 8 minutes. It's just amazing. And there's like all, and the editing is masterful too, because like every shot is just as long as it needs to be. And you're confused and wanting more, but not in like a shitty kind of like, well, they're just fucking with me kind of way.
It keeps you up on what is actually happening on the floor, but in a way that's still kind of chaotic, that you feel like you're in the room with them.
Yeah, I felt like I was in the royal court. Like, what the hell is happening? And it's like, oh my God, is Damon kissing? Oh my God, is Sir Criston Cole punching somebody?
He just punched the groom to be. That's insane,
dude. Okay. So yes, maybe we should wait to talk about this later. But like, indeed, you have this mad dash. You've got the Kingsguard surrounding the king. You got someone knocks Rey to the ground. She looks legit terrified now. Where the fuck is Damon in this? He was right by her side. Laenor tries to intervene because he sees, I think at this point you can see that Criston Cole's the one giving Joff the business. Joffrey grabs a dagger, tries to stab Criston Cole. He bats it away because he's a badass in full plate armor. And Laenor gets punched by Sir Criston Cole full in the face. The king consort. Mm-hmm. Harwin does his thing where he carries off the princess. And then Cole just beats this guy's face to a pulp. It's one of the most gnarly. I mean, there's been a lot of gnarly things, but I'll put this up with the mountain putting his thumbs through Oberyn's eyes. It was nasty what he did to this guy's head.
This guy's 100% dead.
No
question about it. I feel like we had questions, you know, in that first tournament when people were getting punched and then hit over and over again in the head. This is unambiguous.
Yeah. So I guess we should, because my question is, so in the books, this happens, but it happens in the context of this 7-day tournament where Sir Criston Cole, who, you know, like every like the way it happens in the book is Rhaenyra gives, I think, Harwin Breakbones her favor in the tournament. And then Laenor, as a, you know, kind of almost like as a jape, as a careless jape, gives it to Joffrey. And they're just having their like swinging power couple good time. Oh, and then Sir Criston Cole gets Alicent's favor. And then he described that he rains blow after blow on Joffrey's helm until it splits. And he goes into like, I think, a 9-day coma where he eventually succumbs. That is a lot more deniable. Oh, than losing your cool and beating the king consort's best friend to death in the middle of the hall with everyone looking on, completely unprovoked. And it makes me wonder how the fuck the political situation of that is a lot different than it happens in the book. How the I guess does Sir Criston Cole walk away from this? What is the pretext? Do you have any thoughts on that?
My only real thought on this is that he has the queen as a shield at this moment.
She's his sworn protector.
Yeah. Now she is. Both from himself and people who would punish him for this. Yeah. I think that's going to be his saving grace.
And she's sharp enough to like, I think she's in full ally acquisition mode. Not only was that confession shocking to her, but also she's like, you know what? I'm not going to let this guy off the hook. I'm not going to have him killed. I'm just going to chill and see what happens. And then by the end of this episode, I think he is so twisted up and he's ready to kill himself. By the way, this scene out in the garden is gorgeous, of this knight in the white, his bloody gauntlets standing in the moonlight about to kill himself in front of the heart tree. And she stays his hand, man.
Yeah, this whole thing is insane. I mean, it's keeping with, you know, the pattern of Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones weddings are worse than like birthday celebrations in the Bible, where like right. Johnny Baptist gets his head cut off and put on a plate.
Yeah, nothing good happens at those.
No, I think a guy gets hung at another one. It's all bad. It's why the Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate birthdays. It's because they don't like them.
Yeah, out of nowhere, deep bald move lore. I think that because like it's the tenor of the book is like Viserys is annoyed that Sir Criston Cole kind of like cast a pall in the proceedings, but it's like it's a tournament, people die. This is like this was the kickoff feast of 7 days of tourneys leading up to the biggest wedding the realm's ever seen, and now it turns into a hasty shotgun wedding in the carcass of this party.
Yes.
And as I felt like those kids are crying as they're exchanging the vows, like Laenor can hardly get through his vows. Rhaenyra's got red, red rimmed eyes rimmed with tears. They're both like, this is, they thought they were going to be masters of the universe. And now, and she's feeling for herself because I don't think she wanted this to happen. Like,
no. And I don't feel like Criston is an option for her at this point. Right. After this.
Yeah, like if nothing else, Laenor would be like, no, that previous understanding, or at least this particular configuration of it, is null and void. Your guy just killed my guy. Fuck that. No way. No way.
I'm with you.
And then Viserys collapses here at the end, and that crown clattering to the floor seems pretty fucking ominous, man.
Yeah, falls right on the stone. Not the first time he's fallen this episode either. I don't know, man. He seems in pretty bad shape.
Pretty bad shape. Could be the end for him. Yeah, I'm curious. Do you have a prediction as he's to survive in the next week?
I can't say anything. I'm
you got mild. Did you watch the next week on?
Yeah. I shouldn't do that. I really shouldn't.
I got to say that this is the one show where I think it's really risky because, it seems like there's been a lot of people. I've gotten, that's why I've stopped talking about it, is because I got a lot of emails. People are saying like, man, I wish I hadn't seen some of the things. And I don't think we ever talked about it a lot, but a lot of people are kind of like, especially with the time jumps in the previous weeks, it's like, man, I wish I wish I'd stayed away from that stuff.
Yeah, I never know quite what to do with those because, look, it's officially released material. You know? It's not like, oh, this stuff leaked and we're talking about it. They want you to know this stuff. So
I figure, I don't want to tell people about it
unless they seek it out too. Because there's
like tons of podcasts out there that will tell you that and more. Like again, that's the other thing I've listened as I've gone around and listened to some of our peers. Is some of them are a little bit more free about hints and innuendo and spoilers and not. And we try to stay out of that. So like, yeah, mm-hmm. if you wanna get like speculation based on a 60-second trailer for the thing you're gonna watch, and I kind of like that's how I've been in the last couple of years. Is like if I know I'm gonna watch something, the last thing I want to see is a trailer. Because especially the Hollywood releases, I feel like they just really ruin movies nowadays, with rare exceptions. So I'm content to just see what happens next week.
I have one more question for you. Something I noticed that I don't know why they did this, because they could certainly make it different. So Laris observes like, oh, the queen's wearing green. You know, that means war for the Hightowers. But then Alicent goes up to her aunt and uncle to say hi, and they're both wearing green. And like, is the whole damn Hightower clan in on this? Because are they all declaring war? Did she send a raven and say, hey, wear green, we're going to send a message? But it was too late for that to happen. So like, why does the production have them both in green if this is meant to be a statement? Because sometimes a green dress is just a green dress. I know it's not in this situation, but the aunt and uncle's green dress and green garb is definitely just green garb.
I think it's different. Like that was like kind of there's always portrayed as a faux pas in the old series, that like Cersei and her kids dressed much more in like Lannister colors than they did the, you know, you'd be forgiven to even think that they were Baratheons, right?
Totally.
I think that, I think that they're, it's one thing for the lord of a house, a great house, to wear their battle colors and, you know, just whenever they want to, because like that's their fucking house, man. He's the guy who would call the banners. It's another thing for the queen to show up late and give everyone, because the other thing is she stepdaughtered Rhaenyra. I don't think she's ever done that where she's like, I'm very happy for you, stepdaughter. This is such an excellent match. You know, like that's the first time she's pulled that shit. Like, you know, like a little, she's little broing or sunning her.
Yeah, she's not a friend anymore, right? She's her stepmother.
Yeah, so it's the whole package. It's like if she just wore in a green, if she was at the king's side wearing a green dress and keeping a civil tongue to Rhaenyra, I don't think anyone says anything. But her coming in late, making a spectacle of herself, and firing, you know, the stink eye left, right, and center everywhere. She took a couple pages from Galadriel's book from The Rings of Power, with that megawatt stink eye she's got. I think that's it's the totality of the circumstances.
So then why? Why make a deal at all of her? Why show her going up to her aunt and uncle and saying hi to them? Who cares, right? Like, what's the point of that shot?
It's to show that, like, other people besides the two strong boys got the message.
They're
people that are potentially
that she's
her allies.
Playing the game now.
Yeah. 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 I think that's exactly what it is.
Okay. And maybe they did show up wearing green to make a point. You know, Otto was dismissed as the Hand. Maybe they are declaring war on the crown. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay. That makes a certain amount of sense. Anyway, yeah. So we haven't really talked too deeply about, like, what potential consequences, you know, Kristen could face. I think, like, he's not likely to face a ton because he has the Queen as the shield. But, like,
how does she shield him?
By fiat? By just saying you're
so
not
I noticed
kill
that
Kristen.
Like one thing, the recurring thing this episode is Viserys calling for his wife because he's used to her being her comfort and her soft hand and she's nowhere to be found. I wonder if she'll use some of her queenly powers to be like, look, if you want my will of complicitness in this all this bullshit, then you're gonna have to let me have Sir Criston Cole. Mm-hmm. Point blank period. But like I honestly don't know how they square this political calculus, because he assaulted the king regent. He endangered the heir. from the realm's point of view, unprovoked started this whole fracas that ended up killing the best friend and sworn shield of the said King Regent. Like, I get it that Alicent has a lot of soft power, but yeah, how the fuck does how the fuck does Lionel Strong let this happen?
Right.
You know, what is the rest of the small council? It's like, well, yeah, okay. And like I said, maybe Viserys. I'm wondering if this is the play where like Viserys finally starts having to take Alicent serious.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it could be.
It seems like a hard corner to turn.
There's a point you mentioned where Joffrey pulls a knife and tries to stab Kristen, who's on top of him, just beating him mercilessly.
Yeah, right.
So it's clearly self-defense, but I wonder if that's going to be twisted and somehow like Kristen will
he pulled a knife.
He was going after someone.
Oh,
so I stopped
there is
him.
A way that they could use Laenor's rumored gayness of like, oh, he had, this is his jealous lover and he couldn't stand, you know, that he was going to be taken by this beautiful young teenage girl. And he went gay crazy and tried to stab. Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see the realm buying that line of bullshit.
But will Kristen go along with that? I know he's already broken his oath, but God, just telling an outright fabrication like that doesn't seem.
Yeah. Is he like the Anakin
character?
Skywalker type where it's like, you know, in the Revenge of the Sith, where he's like, oh my God, what have I done? I am now yours to command it. Like, you know, it's like you murder a couple of sand people and then you kill a couple of younglings and then you're just irredeemably evil. Like, is he just so more, maybe he's kind of like the Hound where he has had he believed in all this knightly bullshit and saw how utterly bankrupt it all is at the highest levels, and it's going to make him go dark.
Yeah, he's fully jaded in the span of one episode.
Darth
Crispin is born.
What a fall for Sir Crisp.
Yeah. I don't know, it's gonna be interesting to see what happens next episode.
That's indeed. Same.
That's it.
Is that gonna do it for us?
Yeah.
All right, that's our thoughts. What are yours? HotD@baldmove.com is how you get a chance to get read out and find out our thoughts and your thoughts on the follow-up feedback podcast. It'll be out sometime Thursday. Again, HotD@baldmove.com is how you get us that stuff. And we also, the best way to follow us is on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove. If you would like to get ad-free feeds and be able to participate on our live after show, each Sunday night, immediately after the episode airs, make sure you check out support.baldmove.com to get that and many other features and help keep us pumping out the podcasts. We'll see you Thursday for the feedback. One last time, hotd@baldmove.com. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.